Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
The focus again is on films this week. It's been a goodish week for comedies, but a slightly less overwhelming time in the horror department.
Yes, a bit more to say about that later. If you've been to our website, cravepodcast.com, lately, you'll have seen Steve's enthusiastic endorsement of War Dogs, which we'll be talking about very soon, along with Bad Moms. You say moms or mums? We say mums in England, but they say moms in America, don't they?
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah. Moms,
yeah. Don't you wish they wouldn't?
Yeah, I don't say mom. Anyway. And I've also been to see the thriller, the latest shark thriller called The Shallows.
Excellent. And I've been in charge of music this week. I was at a semi-secret warm-up show for Passenger, the English folk pop singer who supported Ed Sheeran on his New York date, his New Zealand dates last year.
You wish he was in New York. You wish he was seeing him in New York.
Yeah, I don't know where that one came from. It's your reference to Americans that put me off.
Sorry.
If in doubt, blame your partner.
Never fails. So
we'll try that again. Who supported Ed Sheeran on his New Zealand date last year? And he's about to do another Australasian tour. We'll have more details of that later. And there has been a rather huge music tour announcement this week. But we'll save that until the end of the show.
We want you to hang around. Okay, let's start with films. And a film which has a title, War Dogs. It's directed by a guy, Todd Phillips. Steve, this is the guy who a lot of people will know him from the films, the Hangover series of films, which are full of sex and drugs and a bit of violence and lots of profanity. And when you saw the trailer to this film, you might have thought, oh, this has a similar feel to it.
But yes.
I actually didn't think it was an out-and-out comedy at all. It ended up being, quite a serious commentary in many ways on the grimy, grubby world of arms dealing and how a couple of, based on a true story, effectively, about a couple of young American guys who found a loophole in the way that the American military contracts for ammunition and arms and equipment, and they exploited it, and boy, did they exploit it.
Yeah, it's based on an article written in Rolling Stone magazine several years ago called Arms and the Dudes. It's ostensibly a true story about these two fellas. Ephraim Divaroli was the originator of the whole plot. He played quite superbly, I thought, by Jonah Hill, who clearly was having a lot of fun in this role.
The top, but it sort of worked for him, didn't it?
It did. He played a sort of a borderline psychopathic character who remarks at one point that he can be anybody that he needs to be, depending on who he's talking to. And he figured out that the American government were required to put out to tender any purchase that they needed to make for the military, because there had been corruption involved previously and now everything had to be completely transparent, and anybody was allowed to bid for any job that they wanted. So we start off with him hooking up with his old schoolmate David Packhouse, played by Miles Teller, at a mutual friend's funeral.
Yes.
In Miami.
And the original premise, or the way that it's pitched to David, isn't it, is that we can feed on the crumbs, on the small little contracts, because there's so many of them that we can actually make a lot of money. We don't have to be going for the big contract, many millions of dollars, because there's apparently a publicly accessible website you can go to, and you can see every contract there that the American military is putting out. This is true.
Go to cravepodcast.com and look at my review on the website. I actually have a link to that website.
Oh, thank you.
Fedbizops.gov.
Lovely.
In the interests of American transparency. And so the story basically then is of these two getting greedier and greedier, trying to get bigger and bigger contracts, and things starting to fall to pieces when they are introduced to a huge contract that involves millions upon millions of rounds of ammunition for the Afghan police. And they're introduced to the deal by a legendary arms dealer named Henry Gerard, who's played quite brilliantly by Bradley Cooper.
Yeah, he does. He looks disturbed and manic, but compelling.
Yeah, that's a nice description of him. I'll take that one.
Okay. And, One of the things that I was really interested in, why don't you do, Steve? I try not to read what other people's reviews of films, so I'd like to get my own thoughts, you know, going into a film.
But oh, definitely.
I couldn't help, unfortunately, come across an article by one of the Guardian's film reviewers who felt that this film just glorified these two guys too much as sort of sympathetic characters and didn't get, you know, show the immorality of what they were doing effectively enough. And I actually disagreed with that. I thought, as I was going along, I kept thinking, boy, do I hope you two get your comeuppance, because you do, you know, you're making all this money out of the misery and death and mayhem that has been wrought upon these other countries by these arms you're procuring. I actually felt quite serious thoughts rather than quite lighthearted thoughts as I was watching the film.
Yeah, I'll be a little bit more subtle than that, I think, to be honest. I found Jonah Hill's character, Ephraim Diveroli, like I say, he's the one who originates the idea, foul. In an engaging way, but he was not a good person. That was made abundantly clear.
Yes.
I think David Packout, was played by Miles Teller, got a much more sympathetic reading.
Yes, but Steve, was that because he was the one telling the story? Because it was his voice we were hearing, and I guess he was the one who spoke to the Rolling Stone magazine. I mean, I kept on thinking we're getting a bit of a filtered view here, and I mean, that I'm sure there's a lot of truth in the story about where they went and what they sold and who they had to meet to get there, but I did think, yeah, I'm getting your side of the story, David. Is your mate really as bad as that? And were you really as the one who was feeling more challenged morally by what you were doing? Did you feel that at all?
I'm not sure I'm quite as bitterly cynical as you there, Simon.
I've been a journalist too long. What can I tell you?
But that's a fair reading. I find myself struggling to disagree with you. On the whole, I did find that the film worked, though. I thought you got two interesting characters who, in particular, in the case of Jonah Hill's Deveroli, was really well drawn.
Yeah, yep, yep. Absolutely. Was he the one who talked about the ugly American? Was that his script line? I think it was him who said that at one point.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, which kind of, that's where he played that role down to the hilt, didn't he? I mean, it was, then some.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's listed really as, I mean, let's see what phrase IMDb choose to describe it as. They list it as comedy crime drama. Now, the crime aspect of that is questionable. Comedy and drama, what do we reckon?
I agree with what you. I think you used the phrase black comedy, and I think that's absolutely the right way to put it. But certainly there's a lot of drama, political. It's as much a political drama as a crime drama in some ways. And here, I think it is a commentary on arms dealing. I mean, that's what it, and it's a commentary on the huge military, American military industrial complex, isn't it? And what, how it ticks. So it's kind of quite thought-provoking in its own sort of way. The only other thing struck me about it was when I was trying to weigh up the plausibility or the implausibility of it, and you sort of have to remind yourself, if it's broadly true and these guys were really only in their 20s, maybe what they did was the sort of thing that two clever but not worldly wise 20-year-olds would do. You know, they just went for it.
Well, yeah, as you say, slightly naive, but yeah, certainly game. Yeah. And you could imagine at that age, you know, some people just go trekking across Asia. These fellas decided they were going to start smuggling handguns across Iraq. It's the kind of thing that youth and stupidity could easily lead you to do.
Yes, think so. So, I mean, I would actually, I definitely recommend it. I don't go along expecting wall-to-wall belly laughs, but
no.
I think it's a good, thought-provoking film.
Yeah, one thing I would like to mention about it, incidentally, is the music.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, aside from one of the bleakest moments of all, I don't know if you remember this, earlier on in the film, when Packhouse is still trying to make a living, trying to sell bedding to old folks' homes.
Yes.
We have a wonderful scene of a singer singing to the inmates of an old folks' home.
Oh.
and he's singing Don't Fear the Reaper.
Yeah, I know.
And here's a little nugget that ties in nicely with your idea of the film being sympathetic to Packhouse.
Yeah.
Guess who plays the singer who sings Don't Fear the Reaper?
Don't tell me it's the actual David Packhouse.
Well, that's what it says in IMDb.
Oh, my God. Is that right?
And with a name like that, let's face it.
Right.
There can't be that many people with that name.
No.
So we're assuming that, yeah, he was involved in the production of the film, clearly at a somewhat deep level. So yes. You have to figure that probably it gets a fairly sympathetic telling on his part. But I also noticed the use of music, I thought, struck me, because if you remember recently, we gave a bit of a savaging to Suicide Squad.
Yes.
For the reason being, it was rubbish.
That technical reason, yes.
Yes, yeah. We're professionals, we can say that. But yeah. one of the many, many things that was rubbish about that film was its use of music.
Mm-hmm.
The soundtrack to Suicide Squad, it's got Bohemian Rhapsody, it's got House of the Rising Sun, it's got Sympathy for the Devil, the finest rock song ever written, and it was just thrown in without any consideration to does it actually belong where it is. They used Dirty D's Done Dirt Cheap because there was an Australian character whose superpower was being Australian.
Yes, yes.
Which, as far as I'm aware, isn't a superpower. It was.
Most Australians think it is a superpower, but anyway.
But they would, wouldn't they?
They would. Yes.
But the thing is, that this is basically, this wasn't a soundtrack. This was, look at me, haven't I got a fantastic record collection?
Yeah.
And it was just, they were just tossed in as afterthoughts. What struck me with War Dogs is that the soundtrack fitted the what the visual, the story, the mood, it worked so much better. The moment when it really hit me strongest was when they were, as I say, trying to drive a truckload of handguns across Iraq.
Uh-huh.
The backing music, if you remember.
I think you're talking about Creedence Clearwater Revival, Fortunate Son.
What a fantastic song to play at that moment. It just worked.
Well, actually, I made a note of that. This is interesting that you and I both... I made a note of that because that song is, of course, is Fortunate Son, isn't it? That's famously... I mean, it's a fantastic rock song.
Yes.
Brilliant guitar. But it's an incredibly cynical commentary on, who gets in and who gets out of the military and who escapes the draft and stuff like that, isn't it?
It's entirely what it's about.
Yes. So when I heard that, I was thinking, oh, is this a double play on... Are they introducing a song which they, at first glance, might you think is some sort of patriotic American war song, but actually isn't? It gave me some pause for thought. It was a clever use of it. It was a thought-provoking use of it.
It just made me think that if you're going to put in a song like that, then that's how you do it. You don't just simply toss it in because it's a song that you happen to like.
Yeah.
Just one thought. That's the way it should be done.
Okay. So we both think you should buy a ticket. I think we're saying what we're saying to War Dogs.
I would say to War Dogs, I would say woof woof.
I'll
edit that out. That was bad. I apologise for that. Yeah, definitely, definitely buy a ticket. It was good.
Now we've talked about the another film which is very much touted as a more straight up sort of comedy, a social comedy.
Yes.
I can tell you, I'm sure you're going to tell me something reasonably similar, Steve. When I watched this film, there were a number of women in the audience, and I could hear them guffawing and belly laughing and giggling periodically. I'll edit that out. Pretty regularly.
No, that one's staying in. That is so inappropriate, it has to stay in.
Sorry. Pretty regularly is what I'm trying to say. Regularly throughout the film. So this film, Bad Moms, talking about why the pressure on working women to live up to some sort of ideal of being a perfect mother, and why we should forget about it and they should be allowed to make mistakes and be real people. That was certainly striking a chord with many women in the audience when I was watching the film.
Yes, and it's funny that you should make such an incredibly insensitive and crass joke. because I'm going to suggest that menstruation is possibly the one thing they didn't touch on in this film.
Yes, you're right. I don't think they did.
They went just about everywhere else.
They did, that's for sure.
Yes. The quick overview, very, very simply. Mila Kunis plays Amy, who is a typical cliched American mother does everything by herself. Husband's a complete slacker, doesn't do anything to help the kids. And the mother does everything. She flings herself from school runs to working a full-time job, which is only a part-time job, really, to school runs, to feeding the family. She does everything. She's a martyr, she's a saint, and she's stunningly gorgeous at the same time.
Incredible. Yep.
It's very much an American cliche.
Yes.
To be fair, I did know women like that when I lived in America who did that kind of thing, who did spend their lives chasing from one kid's event to another. But it's very much an American stereotype. It's one that will appeal to American audiences, and a lot of American women in particular will go, yep, I know what you're talking about. And finally, after having run in after run in after run in with the PPTA, I say the PPTA, that's because I'm a union activist in New Zealand, the PTA.
PTA, yes.
That was a slip of the tongue if ever there was one. Yeah. She has a run in with the PTA, which again is a very much an American construct of having the PTA as being this phenomenally powerful presence in a school.
Yes.
The idea that the PTA president has the power to have kids kicked off sport teams.
Yes, yes.
Is not one that's immediately relatable outside America, I don't think. But she has this huge run in with Christine Applegate's character, Gwendolyn, who is the president of the PTA, and decides that because she's not being the perfect mother and perfect wife, she needs to be destroyed.
Yes. So the conflict is set up. The challenge is there for Amy to decide whether or not she can carry on being this perfect mother. And then when her private life starts to fall apart and her dork of a husband is unfaithful, I can say dork, can't I?
Yeah, I think you just did.
Yeah, and that's how he's portrayed.
Yes.
Which I think is one of the cliches that perhaps is a failing of the film. But anyway, there's the conflict between, as you say, Gwendolyn, the PTA queen mother, and Amy. And I think that, for me, Steve, the point they were making about bad mothers or so-called bad mothers was actually a good point. It was worth... It was interesting that the humour, there was some sharp humour, some laugh-out-loud humour. The other two sidekicks, played by Kristen Bell and Catherine Hahn, I think it's Hahn, mm-hmm. That's how you say her name, they were good. They bounced off each other really well. The humour was quite confronting, a lot of sexual references. And that part was good. And I think that I could tell by just the vibe in the audience that was connecting, but that was all wrapped up in just such a, for me anyway, Steve, such a cliched rom-com type story. You knew it was going to happen. Some of the other characters, I mentioned the dorky husband, and there's this fantastically good-looking widower who's played by Jay Hernandez. The character's called Jesse. The two kids of Amy, I thought the daughter, I think it's Jane, I found her ingratiatingly... Ick is the word I've written down. Can I say ick? Ick is what they've...
We'll allow it. Yeah,
I just thought, no. I thought a lot of cliched characters around about, and you knew where you were going to get. You knew where you were going to be heading with the story. It's just a matter of whether along the way, it was entertaining and thought-provoking.
Yeah, and along the way, I mean, my opinion was that it started off trying to tick every gross out box it possibly could, and it ticked quite a few, to be fair.
Yes. Yep.
But it was cliche ridden in the extreme. How many times do we have to see party scenes with rooms so full of people bouncing up and down they can't move, filmed in slow motion?
Yes.
We've seen that scene many times, and no one's doing anything new with it. So that's a trope that we kind of need to move on from now, I think.
Yeah.
There was the riff that came when they're trying to decide what's going to happen if and when Amy manages to get laid.
Right. Yes.
Involving the hood of a sweatshirt.
Yes.
Do we need to dwell on exactly what that was about now?
No, but
again, like I said, they tried to plumb every possible depth. and it did end up feeling a little bit like let's see just how nasty we can get. Let's just see how gratuitously gross we can get. And there is, let's face it, there's still a shock value when women do it.
I think that's fair. I think that's what the women... in terms of what I could hear around me, that's what women were reacting to. There was that sort of shock value of and of thinking, yeah, they're saying it. Maybe we think it, but they're saying it. You know, that was that sort of idea,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, and many have been allowed to do this for years in cinema. We know that.
Yes.
And so there's a sense, well, okay, even if it is crass and nasty where men do it, women are allowed to do it now as well, so women are going to do it too. And unfortunately, it's very, very difficult to get right when blokes do it. It's every bit as difficult to get right when women do it. And I don't think that men do it right very often.
Yes.
And I'm not completely convinced that women did it right in this case.
No.
But they certainly tried.
Yeah. I think, actually, in some ways, one of the best parts of the film, and that perhaps you might remember the longest, is in the closing sequence.
Yeah. So are we going to give too much detail away
where you
here?
Actually get to... I'm not going to. I'm just going to say that in the closing sequences, we are introduced to some other women
who
provide a
interesting context
and a more insightful context into what you've just been watching through the course of the film. And we shouldn't give too much more away than that. But
no, that was definitely Don Simon.
Thank you. That actually was as compelling as anything else in the film for me.
Well,
so there you are.
It gave a little bit of a heart to a film that was kind of going, as you say, it was just descending into cliched rom-com territory toward the end. You kind of knew where it was headed. That just restored your faith in the film a little bit, I think, didn't it?
I think it did. I think it did. So I wouldn't throw up my hands and say, don't go, don't go, don't go, because you are going to get some laughs out of this film.
Yes.
But you will also feel that you're dining in a restaurant you've dined at before.
This is indeed true. What I would recommend is don't take your elderly mother-in-law to see this film.
Don't tell me.
Debbie and I, my wife and I, went to see it together, and as we were getting ready to leave, she said, should we invite my mother along? I said, no. Oh, but she likes film. She likes going to the pictures. No, don't do it. We took my mother-in-law along. She was appalled.
Oh, dear.
She commented on the way out that if they'd taken every instance of the F word out, it would have been 30 minutes shorter. And she's probably about right, to be fair. they also would have meant that Catherine Hahn had very, very little to do with the entire film.
Yes, 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 yes. But, it's an intergenerational experience for you there, Steve.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, not bad. We've seen better films this year. We've seen worse.
Yes, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Buy
a ticket if you absolutely have to, but don't buy one for your mother-in-law.
No. Now, should we, in this free-form discussion that we're having, Mr. McCabe, take a breather from film and discuss music, or would you like to save your music to the end and shall I plough on into the waters of the shallows? What would you like?
Plough, my dear boy, plough.
All right. Well, this is a film that I caught up with because I do like a good thriller.
You do?
I do. I look forward to a good thriller. And this had the look... A film called The Shallows. It had the look of something that I thought, oh, this just might, you know, do the business for me. And my overall thought is it is good. It is a classy thriller. It looks good. It's got some genuine tension and thrills. But it could have been great. It could have been great, but it just had, which is kind of what we're talking about with the Bad Mums, an over-Hollywoodized, that's a new verb, by the way, ending, particularly... For me, it just fell short, which is a great pity. So basically, this story is about a woman called Nancy, played by Blake Lively. She's a young woman. She's a med student, but she's dropped out of med school. She's on a pilgrimage to a beach in Mexico, which her mother visited when the mum was pregnant with Nancy.
Okay.
Nancy's mother has since died of cancer, and so Nancy wants to go back to the beach for some sort of reflection and some sort of emotional reconnection. Interestingly, she doesn't know the name of the beach, raising an odd question or two about how she directs her guide to take her there. But anyway, never mind. that niggle aside, the setup actually is really good, Steve. Nancy's also a surfer. She meets a couple of other guys, local guys on the water. They enjoy surfing for the afternoon. The film really is really nicely shot. The water scenes are great. And there's a very simple but very clever use of graphics, on-screen graphics, to show how Nancy's talking to her on her phone, her iPhone, to her family, and her dad's trying to persuade her to go back to med school and finish her degree, blah, blah, blah. And then later in the day, that day, the tension kicks in when Nancy goes back for one last surf by herself and realizes that just a little further offshore, there's the carcass of a whale floating there, which is, among other things, providing a rather hearty meal for one big shark.
Oh, dear.
Right. So, Spanish director, his name, Jaume Colletzera, I'm not quite sure, my Spanish isn't my strong point, he builds this up really, really well. He gives us less of the shark for a long time, which, of course, gives us, as the audience, more. And the initial sort of brushes with the shark are really gripping. They're well done. And I don't know about you, Steve, how many times have we seen any sort of film where, you know, the camera's underneath looking up and you see a surfer or a swimmer at top with their arms and legs flailing? And it's a cliched shot, but in this film, it still works. I can't – I know I'm going to see it, but it's still a tense shot. There's something about the way it works. So I was thinking, yeah, this is going well. He's delivering it in a clever way. Nancy's medical training stands her in good stead. And Blake Lively does a good job. You know, she's playing a young woman who's scared, but she's not scared out of her wits. And she does that quite well. And I think the thing that I was really taking from the first half, even two-thirds of the film, was this has the realm of something that could actually happen.
Right.
You know, which made me think, yeah, this is working. This is working really well. You know that there's a but coming, don't you?
I can hear it. You're building up to one, definitely.
Well, the first thing is, when we finally get a good look at the shark,
it
is big. It's a tank with fins. I mean, it's so big that I found myself distracted thinking, is that really, could it be that big? You know, I mean, it could have been so much better to have been a little bit smaller, and it would have just felt part of what was... could have been a real life drama, and distracted me.
Did it sort of cross over to like comedy shark kind of territory? Was that the sense you got?
No, the CGI was good, so it was done in a realistic way. It wasn't a Bruce from Jaws type special effects, but I just thought it's a couple of shots where you just see the size of it, it looked like a whale. I mean, I just thought it was too big. But anyway, that could be just me and my cynicism.
That's good.
But the predatory behavior of the shark is the other thing which you. For me, as I went along, I start thinking, again, this is that Jaws thing again. You know, does it keep coming back? Does it keep going after one person idea? Especially in this film, when you know there's this big carcass of a whale floating out there with a ready meal.
Yeah.
Shark all the time. So I found that a little bit distracting. And without giving it away, I would just say that the ending is certainly clever. It's certainly dramatic. But I just thought, how plausible is that? And it just took it into a realm of sort of another against the odds thriller where you kind of know it probably couldn't happen like that. It was a shame. It could have been really, really fantastic as a thriller. I still think it's probably one of the best ones I've seen for a while. And maybe because I'm not a shark expert, I've come to one or two wrong conclusions here about sharks. But it didn't quite deliver at the final. But for a probably was an independent, had the feel of an independent sort of a film.
Right. I did notice it's listed on IMDb as being an hour and 26 minutes.
Yeah.
And that could be a really good thing.
Yeah. It didn't feel too long. It had a good pace.
Yeah.
The other characters, mainly Blake Lively is the main character, and you see her most of the time, and she does very well. And the other characters have a really absolute normal, odd word to use, but they just felt like normal people.
Right.
They may not even have been actors, I don't know. So that it all worked really, really well. And there was actually, Steve, do you remember, it's probably a few years ago now, off one of the West Auckland beaches, there was a terrible incident where a man was killed by a shark when he accidentally swam through an area where there were fish in a shoal and a shark was feeding on fish.
Oh, dear. This is going to end badly, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, he died. And that actually came to my mind when I saw the carcass of the whale. I thought, yeah, you know, these sort of things do happen. So, the premise was good. It was a good premise and well delivered, just a bit of an over-the-top ending, just took the gloss off for me.
That's a shame, that. So what are we thinking? Should I buy a ticket?
Well, do you like thrillers?
It depends. A well-done one, a nice, tautly tense one. Yeah, I can go for it.
Well, I think you probably would enjoy it. I might be being a little bit harsh on the ending, but for me, that's how I felt. But it's really well delivered. You know, it looks good. It looks like a classy thriller. It's not it's not B grade in any sense like that. It's the story just took a bit of an extra tweak at the end there that just
fair enough
robbed it a little bit. But I would still probably say, yeah, I think you'd probably enjoy it.
A less than resounding but reasonably enthusiastic endorsement then.
Yes, I wanted to like it just a bit more.
Fair enough.
Enough of me prattling on about sharks. I would like to hear about another method of transport. If I'm a passenger.
Oh dear, that was contrived.
I know.
That was almost painful.
It was off the top of my head as well.
I know. Well, let's do it. I went to see Passenger.
Yes.
At the Tuning Fork in Auckland.
Okay.
Last week. Now, this was, I guess, a secret show, really. Passenger is, for those of you who aren't terribly familiar, he is a folk singer from England. He goes by the name Passenger. He's known to his mum and dad as Mike Rosenberg.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him last year, early last year at the Civic in Auckland, and I found him to be a little bit grating. He has a slightly high pitched, warbly voice.
Right.
It was okay. I then saw him opening for Ed Sheeran back in November, and same singer, same songs, and I was much more impressed. He hadn't changed any. I think I just had. I clearly acquired the acquired taste that he definitely is.
Okay.
And I found his show when he was playing with Ed Sheeran much more enjoyable. So, and also I have a wife and a daughter who are big fans. So, I managed to score tickets for his. Basically, it's an album release. Show he was doing, because he's just recorded a new album at Neil Finn's Roundhead Studios here in Auckland.
Okay, yes.
And apparently he's got something of an affection for New Zealand.
Oh, good on him.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, yes, okay.
What right-thinking person doesn't? So he's playing in Auckland, and he was at the Tuning Fork, and it's a tiny venue to begin with. We were at the front of the venue, at the stage. I could have reached out and strummed his guitar myself had I felt so minded. Although
I'm not sure what he would have thought of that,
or indeed the audience who were loving every second of it.
Yes.
And he's definitely growing on me. I was very very impressed. For those of you who aren't familiar, I mean, basically it's one man and a guitar.
Yes.
He's got a capo on his guitar up to the sixth fret all the way through, so he's playing fairly high pitched music.
Right.
But he has got more stage presence and more enthusiasm for the sort of the delicate folk songs that he sings than anybody else I've ever heard. He engages with the audience. There's one song he plays called I Hate, mm-hmm. which is a litany of all the things he hates in the world.
Okay.
And the audience sing along with every single word of it. And after every other line, he stops and talks about these things that he hates and then carries on with the song and then stops again
nice.
And talks about it. It's a very, very engaging show, very, very enjoyable. Mm. He played his big hit from a couple of years ago, Let Her Go.
Right.
I say he played it. He played it and the audience sang it.
Ah.
It's one of those. Everybody knew, except for me, knew every single word. And he was brilliant.
Good. So can I just ask you, are we talking about mostly, for want of a better word, ballads, or are they a bit more up tempo? Or
about three quarters, I would say, are delicately finger picked ballads.
Right. Okay.
The occasional strummed out. I hesitate to use the word rocker, but slightly more upbeat and bouncy.
Yeah.
But beautiful, beautiful music. And about four songs in, he did something that I think he deserves a lot of credit for.
Yes.
He said that, you know, he's a folk singer,
yeah.
and used to be a busker. And he said, you know, when he first got started, it was him and a guitar and nothing else.
Yes.
And he said, I still miss doing that. So he unplugged his guitar, stepped down off the stage, walked into the middle of the crowd, and sang a song completely, I mean, I think naked is almost the right word to use here. It was just him and his guitar, and clothes, obviously. But there was nothing else. You knew that anything you were hearing was coming completely from him, and that takes a lot of nerve.
That's fantastic.
Yes.
That's great. And so for those of us who have not been, the Tuning Fork, I mean, what sort of a size crowd would there be there? A few hundred or?
300 or 400 at the most.
Yeah. So everyone sort of parted and gave him a little bit of space in the middle, and they just kind of formed up around him, did they?
That's precisely what happened, yeah. He was maybe two people away from me. I had a view of the back of his head, but you know, he slowly turned around, made sure everyone could hear what was going on, and a very courteous audience who gave him the space he needed, and it was brilliant. I had nothing but respect for him.
Wow, likewise, having heard that story, I think that's a wonderful thing to do. Wow, great stuff. So has he got an album or two out around that people could pick up if they're interested, Steve? Do you know? Obviously at least one, I guess.
Well, as I say, his one big hit, Let Her Go, apparently is one of only like three or four songs that's ever had a billion hits on YouTube.
Wow, okay.
But coming out very, very shortly is his new album, Young as the Morning, Old as the Sea, which apparently is going to be released at the end of September.
Good stuff.
Yeah, and he is coming to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. He's going to be playing at the Civic in Auckland on Tuesday the 17th of January. And that's where I saw him last time. Yeah. And I have to say, it's an amazing venue. It's a beautiful place. And he's exactly the right kind of person to see there.
Yes.
And what's going to be really interesting is when he plays in January, he's bringing a band with him.
Oh.
And I'll be really interested to see what he does with the band, because I've seen him three times in concert now, and once... the day after the Ed Sheeran concert, he busked in Altea Square in Auckland. I've never seen him play with a band. I'm fascinated to see what he does then, because that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, that will be. Oh, that's great. Well, on the basis of what you've just said, I'm seriously considering going along to see him. I love that idea of him just stopping and getting down amongst the crowd. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that was a really, really brave and a really impressive little touch. I was impressed.
Now, I hate them fussy eaters. He cooked them for heaters. Anything that rhymes. They only eat pizza and chips. I hate stepping outside for smoking. Some guy coughs like your lungs are his. And I hate queuing up for festival toilets, especially when you need a shit. Sorry. And I hate the X Factor. You guys hate the X Factor? Yeah. I hate the X Factor for murdering music.
Yeah. Which reminds me, you won't be too disappointed if I happen to mention Bruce, but
I'd be concerned if you didn't.
No.
It's been at least half an hour.
No, but Springsteen, on a number of occasions with his concerts, not quite that, but he, because, you know, people, they start queuing up and gathering around the front of the stage hours before the show begins.
Mm-hmm.
More than once, and it's happened just in this most recent tour, 2 or 3 hours, I think, before the band's meant to turn up, he actually goes out, you know, in the mid to late afternoon with just his guitar, and will sing a few songs just for the people who are out there waiting.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Just to keep them tied over for a while.
Oh, that's fantastic. I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, so you can YouTube that, and you'll find a few examples of when he's done that. And I mention that also because I'm looking forward, I'm not sure whether we'll have time to refer to it in detail next time, but maybe the time after. He's got his autobiography coming out in a week or two or three, which you won't be too surprised to hear I might just purchase.
Wouldn't be the biggest shocker ever, though.
No. I'd be very interested to hear what... I've read a little bit of his writing in terms of, you know, when he writes an album and the liner notes that go with it. He's got quite a good... he can write a good line, and so I'm quite looking forward to that. And I just wanted to mention one other thing that's coming up, Steve. I did flag last time in the last podcast, I was going to keep an eye out for the beginning of a 6-part series on TV1 about Sir Edmund Hillary.
Yes, you did mention that.
Everest. Two things. I've not seen the first episode, and the second is this weekend, but I thought I will look at it on demand and maybe see two or three in a run to get a feel for where the whole thing is taking me. And so I might just save that up and talk about it in a bit more detail in another episode or two, because he is for those people who grew up in this country, he was New Zealand for several generations of people in this land. He epitomised what being a New Zealander was.
National saint, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Speaking of such matters, I think there's another band that actually need a very quick mention this week.
Yes.
Speaking of epitomising what it means to belong to a certain country.
Yes.
Are you familiar with a Canadian band called The Tragically Hip?
No, it's ringing a little bell, but not much. No, go on.
No, see, were you Canadian? You would have known them.
Yeah, I'm sure.
They've been around for about 25 years.
Oh, okay.
Started out as conventional classic rock and then sort of developed their own very, very unique sound.
Yeah.
Typically, their albums would get to number one in Canada.
Right.
And they never made the top 100 in the US. They were, and I'm using the past tense quite pointedly here, they were the ultimate Canadian band. Their songs were about Canadian things.
Yes.
They were resolutely Canadian. And until earlier this year, their singer and lyricist, Gordon Downie, was diagnosed with glioblastoma, which is a particularly aggressive form of brain cancer.
Yes.
And so they played last weekend their farewell concert.
Wow.
Now, they played this at their hometown of Kingston in Ontario.
Yeah.
It was relayed around the world by the CBC. There were viewing parties in city town squares across Canada. Justin Trudeau showed up to see them and apparently was choking back the tears during the film, during the show.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favourite bands ever.
Oh.
And they're gone.
Oh.
But what an amazing way to go. They basically, your man Gordon Downie bowed out on his own terms.
That's fantastic.
I saw a bit of the show. It was broadcast live by the CBC. And even though he's probably in his last year, but you've never seen a singer sing a more impassioned show.
Ooh, I'm getting goosebumps just listening to you.
Well, it's amazing. I need to vacuum because there was a bit of dust in the air. That's why my eyes were watering. I can't think of any other reason why it must have been. It must have been something in my eye.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd mention that very quickly.
I'm glad you did. Well, okay, mate.
More uplifting matters. We've got good things coming ahead of us.
Yes, we do.
Well, we mentioned already that Passenger's coming back to town.
Yeah.
And that's a definite. Now, we did mention at the top of the show that there's a big music announcement.
Yeah, I think I might have seen a poster or two around town, which is giving me a pointer. But do explain.
Well, we had, see if we can sort of segue into this, when AC/DC came to town last year.
Yes.
AC/DC basically no longer exist as we saw them. Because Axl Rose out of Guns N' Roses took over from the increasingly deaf Brian Johnson.
Yes, I remember that.
And now the wheel turns full circle, and Axl Rose is back singing with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
And they're coming to New Zealand.
Right, and you will be there, will you, with your boots on?
Well, that's the plan. We have requests in for review tickets for Crave.
Lovely.
And we'll see what happens. But
where are they playing, Steve?
They're playing in West Auckland, obviously.
In Western Springs.
Western Springs. Where else would a band like that play in Auckland?
No, well, they couldn't play anywhere else. No,
absolutely. They're playing Western Springs Waitangi weekend.
Oh, okay.
So the Saturday, that's going to be the 4th of February, isn't it?
Mm.
They're going to be playing in Auckland, and then 2 days earlier on the Thursday, they're going to be down in Wellington.
Well, there'll be a huge, huge turnout.
I would imagine so. I know the information was leaked a couple of days before the official press announcements came out, and Facebook looked like it was going to melt down. so that was going to be fairly big. So we shall endeavour to cover that one.
I will do our best. Manfully.
It'll be a good show as well. I think that's one where, you know, you're not really just taking one for the team there.
No. Quite right.
Now, taking one for the team, I think, is what we're going to be doing next week when we go to the preview of Bridget Jones' Baby. You're not coming?
No, I will go.
Good. I should hope you will.
Okay.
You can't leave me to see that one on my own.
No, that would be wrong. We'll stride up to that, do our professional duty.
You're about to say manfully, and there's nothing manful about going to see Bridget Jones' Baby.
No.
It's the epitome of all things not manful.
Anyway, no. Well, have you seen the previous? I've saw the. How many have there been now? I think there's at least. Is this the third or the fourth?
That's a very good question.
There's been at least two, I'm sure.
There was the first one. Then there was something about Bridget Jones Into Oblivion or something like that. I can't remember what it was called.
Okay.
I can't remember the exact name of it. This is at least the third.
So, I
don't know, really, to be honest, that we're holding out much hope for greatness in this.
No.
But we shall see.
Okay.
That's going to be playing very shortly. Yeah. Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason, that's what it was called. Yes. Which kind of sums up what they were thinking when they made it, I think.
It does.
I mean, it's a bit like The Shallows. It's a film where the title kind of reviews itself.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes.
Yeah, I'm being unfair. You saw the film, I didn't.
Yeah. All right.
So that's coming up shortly.
Yeah.
Then another one that's being press screened very shortly is one called Nerve.
I have seen the shorts of that.
Yes.
Yes.
Promising?
Possibly. Possibly a... It's very much a take on the modern... on the YouTube, iTunes, iPhone generation, and the world of social media, where everyone knows what everyone else is doing, and daring people to do things, and there's a good idea there. It's hard to say from the trailer, just how good it is, but sounds like a good idea. So probably one worth reviewing, I would have thought.
Well, we'll certainly give it a look. The lead is Emma Roberts. That would be Julia's girl.
Oh, okay.
By all accounts, is making a bit of a name for herself in her own right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we'll see how that one plays. There's not really much of a particularly big name cast in there. There's a lot of B-listers in it. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah,
we'll see.
We've
got Dave Franco from things like Bad Neighbours. We've got Kimiko Glenn from Orange is the New Black. So you know, definitely on the B list.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll judge. We'll let you know next time.
Oh, we will judge. Absolutely. We'll judge harshly and cruelly. And I think even crueler,
yes,
is going to be Sausage Party.
Now, have you seen the trailer for that?
Yes, I have.
I thought the trailer, the first couple of... visual images make you think it's another one of those kids movies, and then
yes,
they start talking, and then you realise it's nothing, anything but.
In fact, I'm led to believe this is the first M-rated full-length animation.
It was only a matter of time. Hey, it's worth having a look at, possibly, just on that basis alone.
It has the potential, if they actually cash in the potential, and I hope they do, to be hysterically funny.
Yeah. It might be... to those sort of films, what Deadpool was to the superhero films, perhaps.
That's kind of what I'm hoping for, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue is a lot of these films, they can often run out of steam after about the first 20 minutes. We'll see how well they manage to play it out, but it does look like it's got a lot of potential.
Yeah. Good stuff. Okay.
So there's some good stuff coming for the next couple of weeks.
Lovely. Well, I think we've had a good chat. We might tie it up and wrap it up in a bow and send it off to Christmas Island or something. I'll stop right now because I don't know what I'm saying. But this
I don't
has
know
been...
where you were going with that, seriously.
Know. This is Crave. That's what you'll be listening to. And we'll be back soon with more to talk about, that obviously, music and film. If you want to get in touch with us, really like to hear from you, you can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, although quite frankly, after this week's performance, I'm not sure anybody really want to. Or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Good stuff. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.